Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. This weekend, the New England Patriots take on the Seattle Seahawks in Super Bowl 60. The game will be shown on NBC with well over 100 million people watching and streaming across the U.S., plus millions more around the world. It long ago became a cliché to call the NFL's championship game an unofficial holiday. Cliché or not, it is exactly that. The ads, the halftime show, the endless snacks, the Super Bowl is an American institution. And the NFL, the entity that created the Super Bowl, is increasingly a titanic business and cultural force. Consider, the league's revenue now hovers around $23 billion a year, almost triple what it was in 2010 when NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell publicly vowed to reach $25 billion by 2027. According to CNBC, the average NFL franchise is now worth $7.65 billion, up 18% from the previous year. Our hometown Carolina Panthers are worth $6.4 billion. Respectable, but not anywhere near Jerry Jones' Dallas Cowboys at $12.5 billion or Robert Kraft's New England Patriots at $9.25 billion. Jones, Kraft, and Goodell are three of the people most responsible for the NFL's mammoth business gains during the past 20 years. And that rise is the subject of a new book by New York Times reporter Ken Belson. It's called Every Day is Sunday, and Ken Belson is with me today to discuss it. Ken, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you, Eric. Appreciate it.
So your title is spot on. The NFL has become an inescapable year-round machine. We're about to have the Super Bowl. Soon after that, there will be endless media coverage of the Combine, which is kind of this cattle call of college players auditioning for teams' interest. Then we go into the draft. Then we go into the schedule announcement. Then we go into training camp and preseason, and then we're back to the regular season, and on it goes. So let's start with that scenario. How did we get to a world in which pro football dominates every day of the year?
Well, football is interesting because the NFL in particular is very profitable, in part because it has a scarcity of games. There's only 17 regular season games. Most people don't pay attention to the preseason. And so each game actually matters even more, because if you lose two or three or four of your first few games, you could get knocked out of playoff position and so forth. And so if you compare that to, say, basketball, where October, November basketball, most people sort of don't watch. Baseball starts kind of slowly in April and so forth. So football has this amazing scarcity that drives up the value of each game. And of course, viewership is that much stronger. At the same time, the league has recognized, particularly under Roger Goodell, who became commissioner in 2006, that scarcity is fine for the games themselves, but there's a lot of value in the brand of football that the NFL was not fully capturing. And so you read that short laundry list. You could have included free agency in middle March, where they've tried to fill in the calendar with NFL content. Now, the Combine's been around since the 80s, really, but it really took on a life of its own in the last 10 years when we started to get sort of primetime viewing built around it. And this is guys, you know, running the 40-yard dash, and it's not terribly exciting television, but the NFL seems to make it exciting in that sense. And then you get this schedule announcement in May that they also put on. And a lot of this had to do with the fact that the NFL went into its own production business. It started NFL Network. And so it had this vehicle to sort of force feed us a lot more football than we probably imagined we needed.
One of the seminal moments you point to for growth sounds like this. That, of course, heralds the arrival of Rupert Murdoch and Fox in 1994. Why was that such a major move for the NFL?
It was, and that song was described or was conceived as Batman on steroids when it was originally commissioned, and now I can't unhear that. But in any event, that was a seminal moment in the NFL's, certainly in its financial history. The NFL, until that point, had three broadcast packages. CBS had the NFC, ABC had Monday Night Football, and NBC had the American Football Conference. And that was pretty much it. There was some TBS, a couple of cable companies, but really that was the scenario for many years. And Jerry Jones arrives in the late 80s, 89, he buys the Cowboys, and he sees they're going into negotiations for the next round of broadcast rights. And he said, why aren't you running an auction? It's a simple business concept. You get more demand for the number of slots you have. And so Rupert Murdoch had tried twice to get the NFL or some piece of the NFL broadcast rights. But at that point, his network was pretty sparse and pretty far down on the dial. And a small point, he had no sports division. And so twice, once under Pete Rozelle and then afterwards with Paul Tagliabue, they said, no, thank you. We don't know who you are and so forth. But Jerry Jones knew Rupert Murdoch and he told him, you're not going to be a stalking horse. We're going to take you seriously. And so at that point, they had four bidders. The extra bidder was Fox for three packages. And when you get an auction, the price goes up, generally speaking. And so that's, in fact, what happened. The other key thing that he did was he brought over a guy named David Hill, who had been producing the English Premier League. And David was one of the people who brought a lot of the innovations in broadcasting we take for granted. More microphones on the field so you can hear the sound of the players crashing into each other. More cameras in the stadium to get more angles. Out-of-town scores on the screen. These things were not done. It was a much more sober, plain broadcast until then. And so he sold the owners on this concept that we can really jazz up football games. And so the owners essentially took Rupert Murdoch's gargantuan bid at that point and tossed out CBS, who had been with the league for many decades prior. And that was a very bold move. I mean, Rupert Murdoch had no cameramen. He had no announcers. He had no studio show. He didn't even have that music that you just played. So that was a risky move. And in less than 8 months, Fox Sports had to be created. The good news for Murdoch was that CBS was out of the football business and there were a lot of unemployed people. And so John Madden and Pat Summerall came over, the production crews and all of that. So in very, very rapid order, Fox built a sports division. And the rest is history, as they say. They were innovative, they paid more, and they frankly, they pushed NBC and CBS and ABC to innovate as well.
That's the voice of Ken Belson. He is the author of the new book, Every Day is Sunday. We were talking about the rapid expansion of the NFL, more days, more games. Robert Kraft said in a recent interview that the NFL will soon go to an 18-game regular season from the current 17, something that players have opposed staunchly for years. And that, in turn, will allow the league to have every team play one game a year overseas, which would then create a new 16-game package that could be sold separately for probably $1 billion or more on top of the roughly $12 billion they're generating from media rights already. So my question for you is, how likely is this? Because this has been floated time and time again.
It is likely and will continue to be likely. However, they can't get to an 18th game. They can't expand the season by one regular season week unless they have the cooperation of the players' union. And to the consternation of the owners and frankly the players, the union's a bit of a mess right now. They replaced Demora Smith a couple of years ago with a guy named Lloyd Howell, and he left in under 2 years in a sort of cloud. And they have an acting director now, but they haven't found a permanent replacement. And even if they did that tomorrow, it would take that union chief quite a while to get to know the landscape and get to know the players, see what they want to do. So it's not going to happen anytime soon that the league and union reopen their labor contract to add that 18th game. So I don't think it's happening soon, but I think ultimately, as much as you alluded to it, the players are not interested in playing an extra regular season game. There will be carrots on the other side of it. First of all, they'll get more revenue, which will be split up and paid out under the salary cap. But they'll probably expand the rosters, which means more professional football players paid at higher rates. There'll probably be an extra bye week. So there'll be accommodations made for the players as well, and maybe other safety measures. One interesting thing that I think is underreported is that if and when they get to this 18th game, and they'll get rid of 1 week of the preseason as well, the Super Bowl will be pushed back all the way to President's Day weekend.
We've bounced around a little bit here with Jerry Jones, with Commissioner Goodell, with Robert Kraft. Why did you choose these three gentlemen as the focal point of your book on the power of the NFL?
I could have picked others as well. Paul Tagliabue played a huge role in modernizing the NFL, bringing in a more business sense or sensibility, the way the league is marketed. He was around when NFL Network started. There were a lot of things that Tagliabue did to build a financial foundation under which Goodell and the owners have since expanded. But frankly, it gets kind of cluttered. I think the number three kind of works here. You'd still be reading the subtitle of the book if I added too many owners and union chiefs and so forth. So I kept it a little simple. But these three men are still working at the NFL. And, Tagliabue retired in 2006 from the league. So it would have been backward looking, and I wanted to keep that contemporary. Having said all that, I don't think there's much debate that Jerry Jones and Robert Kraft have been the two most influential owners, certainly in my lifetime, when it comes to the business of the league. If I was thinking of a second tier of owners, perhaps Lamar Hunt, formerly, the late Lamar Hunt of the Chiefs, was influential. Dan Rooney, also no longer with us, with the Steelers. But Jerry and Robert, by and large, there's a reason why they're both nicknamed the Shadow Commissioner. They're also both involved in media negotiations, which is really the league's bread and butter. And they're very different people, but I think they have done more than any other two owners to make themselves richer and make the other owners richer.
I'm curious, you go through a lot of the controversies, the less, I guess, cheerful aspects of pro football and these owners. I know it's not your job to like or dislike, but what's your opinion of them as people, having spent so much time around them?
It varies. I mean, the owners are I wouldn't say they're a diverse group, but they're different people. Some owners I've never had much dealings with. Stan Kroenke often doesn't give interviews. I've met him. He's certainly pleasant enough. Other owners are incredibly unassuming. I'll give you one example. At least 10 years ago, maybe more, I was out in Arizona to write a story. It was ahead of one of the Super Bowls out there. And I had asked to meet Michael Bidwill, the owner of the Arizona Cardinals. And his assistant said, yes, Michael will meet you. And he gave me the name of a restaurant in downtown Phoenix. It was a diner or something. And I went there and I was expecting, like you almost always have, there's some PR person or, minder with the owner. No, Michael was just sitting there having pancakes in a booth in a diner in downtown Phoenix. And we sat and talked for 45 minutes. And it was so refreshing to just talk to him. I mean, we're about the same age. It turns out we have mutual friends. I mean, it was very unassuming. It's not what you think of when you're meeting a billionaire. Now, having said all that, Michael inherited his team from his father, who inherited it from his father. And so Michael is not a guy with extreme wealth. He happens to own or be primary owner of a multi-billion dollar asset. So he's a different person. I would say the Rooney family is very similar. There are owners with a lot more money, including in your hometown, David Tepper. I find him refreshing also. He speaks his mind. He's got a ton of ideas. He's very smart. That's all I'm asking for. I don't need to be his friend. I don't need to have a drink with him. But at the same time, he tells me what's on his mind, and that's all I can really ask for.
Well, we do need to take a break, so we're going to do that right now. And when we come back, we're going to have more with Ken Belson and the runaway popularity of NFL football right here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is New York Times reporter Ken Belson. He's here discussing his new book about the business success of the NFL. It's called Every Day is Sunday. You address this in the book, and I'd like to hear you expand on it a little bit here. Not so long ago, in the past decade, the NFL was drowning in controversy over brain injuries, over the CTE findings related to the health problems that players were having. Some former players committed suicide, and there were questions about whether football injuries had led them to health problems that led to them taking their own lives. Michael Vick, a little bit before that, went to prison for participating in a dogfighting ring. There were all these things, the Ray Rice domestic violence controversy. How did the NFL manage to not only get through that, but emerge more popular?
The NFL, and this sort of was apparent to me as I was doing my day job for the New York Times, but also as I started to kind of try and organize it into a book form, the NFL is really run by lawyers and marketing people. Of course, there's the football side and you know, former players and referees and all that. The product on the field is one thing. In the main office, in the headquarters, there are lawyers who limit liability or, you know, make problems go away in one form or another. The concussion settlement, landmark concussion settlement is one example. And the other is marketing people who try and turn bad news into good news. Try and change the subject, try and create solutions to problems that, you know, became apparent. One example, Ray Rice, you mentioned, he was seen on video in two separate videos punching, knocking out his then fiance in an elevator in Atlantic City. It was a gruesome video. The NFL was pilloried for it in part because they had not penalized Ray Rice when the case first came to them. It was a national conversation about domestic violence, and it also was probably one of Roger Goodell's lowest moments as commissioner. He has ultimately apologized for how it all came about in some ways. So having said all that, the NFL then pivoted and produced public service announcements that were on television before and during games, featuring players like Eli Manning talking soberly about the issue. The NFL gave, I believe, was $1 million to a call center in San Antonio, Texas, that focuses on women in dire need. And so, you know, they tried to pivot to that, where we've acknowledged it, but now we want to change it into something positive. And they've done that in numerous issues, post George Floyd. We've seen that there have been other issues, and the concussion issue, I think most broadly, they also have tried to do the same thing and pivot from, in some ways, acknowledging the damage done, but then saying, you know what, how are we going to fix this? And better coaching, better policing of concussions on the sidelines, a whole host of issues. And that's really what they're, I would say, good at. Sometimes it's infuriating to watch, but they are adept at trying to focus on what they consider to be solutions.
With the Super Bowl coming up this weekend, let's talk halftime shows.
Are NFL fans ready for a Super Bowl halftime show entirely in Espanol?
Ni una llamada, ni un solo mensaje, lo brother me lo montan.
Puerto Rican rapper and singer Benito Antonio Martinez Ocasio, better known as Bad Bunny, will headline next year's show. The news was met with backlash by some on social media. That's in part because Bad Bunny has been outspoken in his opposition to President Trump's immigration policies. Now, recently, he opted not to tour the continental U.S. because that was out of fear that Immigration and Customs Enforcement could make their presence known outside of his concert venues.
That was a report from NPR's A. Martinez last year. Now, the president is also unhappy that Green Day is performing, I think, before the game. He said he will skip the Super Bowl. That's unusual for a president who shows up at Super Bowls and college football national championships and other major sporting events. And this is the latest in a series, as you well know from reporting on this, of culture clashes that the league has had with President Trump. But many of the owners, as you write, support Trump and seemed to align with him at times, particularly during his first term when we had the national anthem kneeling controversy and Colin Kaepernick was, in essence, thrown out of the league. How do you explain the shift with Bad Bunny, if you consider it a shift?
I'm not sure it's wrapped up in Bad Bunny per se. I think the NFL, and there's a moment in the book that I described, I believe it's in the chapter on the Super Bowl, about how the owners really were getting quite worried during the player protests originally started by Colin Kaepernick, because musicians were now preemptively saying, if I was invited to play at the Super Bowl, I wouldn't do it. And suddenly there was a backlash from the music community, and it kind of reached a low point, if you want to call it that, in the Super Bowl in Atlanta in 2019 when Maroon 5 played. And I went back and read some of the reviews, and they were roundly panned. I'm no music critic, so I couldn't tell you whether that was a good show or not. I go to the Super Bowl, but I'm usually on break at that point, not listening to the music. But it was really poorly received. And I think Robert Kraft said to Roger Goodell, we've got a problem here. We need to bring the music community back. And so they ultimately struck a deal with Jay-Z and Roc Nation, one of the largest music promoters, to make the shows more contemporary and bring back some of the big names, J-Lo 1 year and so forth. And so they made this deal. It was interesting to me when it came out, because Jay-Z himself had said was opposed to the way the NFL treated Colin Kaepernick. And one owner in particular called me after the announcement that the NFL was going to work with Roc Nation and said, I don't understand. Has anybody listened to his lyrics? I don't think they're family friendly. What are we doing here? But then I called around to a couple of other owners and they said, hey, if this is going to revive the halftime show, then I'm all for it. So I guess I'm saying that my takeaway from this was that the owners were sort of amoral about the issue. I don't think they listened to any of these musicians. It's not to them. I don't think it matters as much as are a lot of people going to tune in, and is it going to make good television and boost ratings? Having said that, and jumping over to Bad Bunny, I think that's in that. It's in that pattern that we're seeing, is that contemporary artists bring younger fans, a different diversity in the fans, whether they're Spanish speaking or whatever. I think that's where the NFL owners are at. I don't think any of them have sat down and dissected Bad Bunny's lyrics and decided in a morality way that he's inappropriate.
Do you think it's a shift away from Trump or any rebuke of Trump?
I don't think so at all. In fact, the NFL, during Trump's second time in office, basically starting last year, has been pretty conciliatory. I mean, he was invited to the Super Bowl in New Orleans last year when Josh Harris, the owner of the Washington Commanders, announced that they were, and Roger Goodell announced they were going to have the draft in Washington, D.C. in 2027. They made that announcement in the Oval Office. Of course, the president has plenty of opinions about the kickoff and all sorts of other things. But I think they've done, they've been a little more strategic at trying to reach out to him rather than just simply wait for him to make a pronouncement. So I'm not saying everything's hunky-dory, but I think they've learned from the previous controversies during Trump 1.0 that they need to have more outreach. And, you know, look, the president's not happy with Bad Bunny. I suspect there's a lot of listeners and fans out there who probably don't like him either, and he's entitled to his opinion. My suspicion is a lot of people are going to watch out of curiosity now because it's ginned up so much interest for an artist that, frankly, I didn't know until he was, chosen. So I think it's actually going to improve ratings in some way because people want to see what all the hubbub was about.
To your point, the NFL always wins. That's the voice of Ken Belson. He's the author of the new book, Every Day is Sunday. A familiar face to Carolina Panthers fans, team founder Jerry Richardson is a big part of one of the chapters in the book. And one aspect of Richardson's time in the NFL that you highlight is his role in labor negotiations with the players' union in 2011. This was a nasty fight. There was a lockout. That was the same year that Jerry Richardson held a rare press conference in Charlotte leading up to some of that labor strife. Here's what he had to say.
One of the first things that is said to me when I meet with the union lawyers, they say, Mr. Richardson, we want more money, more benefits, and we want to work less. And then they say, let's begin negotiations. And I'm not optimistic we're making a lot of progress.
How do you view those statements, given what we know has happened with team and league revenue since then?
Well, the players actually got what they wanted, which is more money and less work, if you want to call it that. One of the results of the 2011 lockout and ultimately the labor deal was they limited the number of full contact practices during the regular season to, I think it was 11 at the time. And so that the players at that time were worried about head injuries and you know, just general body health through the course of the season. And so that was one of the things they won, even if it, you know, came after a lockout. I you know, that part, I think in the end they got what they wanted. They were, as in any labor negotiation, the two sides started further apart and ended up, you know, somewhere in the middle. The general consensus is that the owners got a lot more back than the players got. Of course, the union often disputes that. But in percentage terms, the owners did get a bigger share of the overall revenue pie. There was Jerry Richardson was a pivotal figure in these negotiations. In fact, when the prior deal was signed in 2006, and the players at that point got 53% of the shared revenue, Jerry Richardson knew it was a terrible deal, and he was banging the drum to rip that deal up as soon as they could, and they opted out of it after 2 years. And so it led to a long shutdown, stare down, and then eventually a lockout. But in the end, they really only missed one game. It was the Hall of Fame game. And so, you know, all's well that ends well from their perspective. I think one thing that is often sort of lost in the story about that is Jerry Richardson himself is such a conundrum. I ended up writing I've met Jerry several times, and I ended up writing his obituary for the New York Times. And so I spent a lot of time reading about him. I would have thought at first glance that he would have been much more pro-player or sympathetic to the players, because he was the only owner other than George Halas of the Bears who actually played in the NFL and left over a $500 dispute with the Baltimore Colts. So I would have thought he would have understood where the players were coming from. Their careers are short, they don't make a ton of money relative to the owners and so forth. And yet he was one of the most hardline owners when it came to labor talks. And I think that was partly because he ended up being a self-made billionaire through a fast food empire that he built. And so I think he felt like we all should be pulling up our own bootstraps. So he was a very complicated man in that way. And it came out in the labor talks. And ultimately, the labor talks in 2011, that lockout ended because Robert Kraft got involved, and he basically pushed the most vociferous owners out of the room, and Jerry Jones and Jerry Richardson included, and said, we just need to whittle this down to like two or three people on both sides, or we're never going to get a deal done.
You attended Jerry Richardson's funeral at Wofford College, his alma mater, in 2023. At that point, he had been out of the NFL for 5 years. It is well known here and across the NFL that he left under a very dark cloud. I think that the NFL referred to it as workplace misconduct, harassing employees. They, as the NFL put it, substantiated the allegations. You make some interesting points about who showed up and who didn't. And I think it points to the reason billionaires so desperately want to own one of these 32 franchises. What did you see that day?
Yeah, it was. I was curious. I wanted to witness it myself because, first of all, I thought Jerry was a complicated man, and I had this idea that, you know, these owners are popular and well known, and Jerry Richardson was particularly so because he literally got the franchise in Charlotte. It didn't exist without Jerry Richardson. And so, you know, I always wonder when somebody exits, who's there to you know, celebrate their legacy. And sadly, I only counted three owners out of 31 or 32 who attended. Now, I there may be that caveat in there. I don't remember whether I put it in the book, but there may have been other memorial services or something that some of the owners attended. But several owners told me they tried to make it and couldn't come. Be that as it may, it seemed sort of somber. There were quite a few people there from Charlotte, probably over 500 to 1,000 people there, and there were people from the NFL headquarters, the chief general counsel, and others. But Roger Goodell was not there that day, and I only saw the owner, Michael Bidwell, I mentioned, from the Arizona Cardinals, and George McCaskey from the Bears. It was a pretty thin crowd. As you pointed out, he left under a cloud, and it had been 5 years. But it was sort of a sad statement, because Jerry Richardson had been a very powerful, influential owner and had done a lot of favors for owners, particularly in helping them get stadiums. And it was interesting to see who didn't bother to show up, and said a lot about how when you're no longer an owner, you don't have that gold-plated notoriety anymore.
Particularly because, as you know, he was the co-chair of the committee that named Roger Goodell commissioner. So yes. Bitter irony there. Something I had not thought about. Really good point. You write about how Jerry Richardson, toward the end, when he was losing influence in the league, he didn't want the new money hedge fund and private equity guys buying teams. And yet, he sold his team to David Tepper, who is a hedge fund manager. What do you make of that?
There were three bidders for the Panthers at that point, and David Tepper, you know, it'd be like selling your home. You know, you would sell an all cash deal rather than wait for somebody to get rid of their other mortgage and apply for a mortgage and all that. You take the cash, and David was well financed. He could come in quickly. He was clean in the sense that he didn't have an investment group. It was just David Tepper. I could see from a financial perspective where he ultimately, if Jerry Richardson just wants to get out as soon as possible, David was the obvious guy. The other thing about David Tepper was he had been part owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, I believe up to 10% at one point. And so he was already sort of in NFL circles. And I don't know whether he had met Jerry Richardson prior. He was a minority shareholder of the Steelers, but he already was sort of pre-vetted. Art Rooney and the Steelers franchise spoke highly of him. He had a lot of money. He was kind of do things for the team. He's obviously now improving the stadium and so forth, building a practice facility. So I could see from in financial terms why he would have done that. But you're right. Jerry Richardson, I think he was not in love with some of the sort of more Wall Street tactics that current generation of owners are forging ahead with.
We need to take one more time out. Stay with us. We'll have much more with Ken Belson and Every Day is Sunday right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Ken Belson, who covers the business of football at the New York Times. His new book is called Every Day is Sunday. And before we went to the break, Ken, we were talking about Jerry Richardson and his eventual sale of the Panthers to David Tepper. And earlier in the show, you mentioned that you find Tepper to be one of the more interesting owners in the league. How does the league view David Tepper from what you know and see?
David's interesting. I remember he was attending his first owners meeting, at least the one that I was at. There are quarterly meetings. And I remember he showed up late. And he was sort of not running, but walking very quickly into the space, the roped off area where the owners met. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. Your first big meeting as new owner of the team, and you're not even there on time. So he's a man who sort of juggles a lot. He's flying between Florida, Charlotte, his office in New Jersey. Of course, he's going everywhere else all the time. He's a busy guy. And I think, you know, the NFL wants owners who are engaged and do other work for the league. In other words, not just take care of the Panthers, but get involved in the finance committee or the safety committee or the stadium committee, whatever it is. They need the owners all take part. And frankly, there's only about a dozen owners who do a vast amount of work. And then there's a lot of owners who contribute in fits and starts. So I think David took a few years to sort of get more involved. And I think he has. It's interesting. Art Rooney said that David Tepper was very quiet And if you meet David Tepper, he's not a particularly quiet guy. I mean, he's talking a lot. He speaks in a booming voice, and he's a lot of fun too in his own way. I've enjoyed interviewing him, but yeah, he's now, I think, and then COVID got in the way, and obviously that changed a lot. But he is now a much more outspoken owner within their circle. He's on the finance committee, which is perfect for the business he's in hedge funds. He's a very smart guy. He's making investments, big, multi-million dollar bets on companies and technology, and he thinks very broadly. He's also on the health and safety committee, I believe. He played football as a kid and through high school. So I think he's slowly maybe becoming more in the middle of things, and that's probably good for the league. I will say he's not the only one. Josh Harris came from the private equity world. He owns the Commanders, and I think there's a new generation of owners. I say new because they're in their 60s that are steering the ship in a new direction towards more financialization, I guess, with the introduction of private equity money.
Yeah, and you write about not only the money, which of course flows through the book and flows through the NFL, but you write about this unique billionaires club that ownership is, embodies. And as you point out in the book, it's also a club that's known for relying heavily on taxpayers. Here's how you describe it. Quote, "The owners, many of whom complain about government getting in the way of industry, demand subsidies and tax breaks to help pay for their stadiums, socializing their costs and privatizing their profits," end quote. And let me just share a couple of examples. Taxpayer money is footing the bill for 60% or $1.8 billion of a new stadium for the Chiefs. Taxpayer money accounts for $850 million of a new $2 billion stadium for the Buffalo Bills, $1 billion toward the Commanders Stadium. Here in Charlotte, it's $650 million for an $800 million stadium renovation. You've got Jacksonville, Nashville. You get the point. How did we get here when it comes to subsidizing stadiums?
I would say it's not only the NFL that's responsible for this. Baseball and basketball, other sports, the owners have leaned on local officials to help contribute to the cost of these stadiums. But I would say in NFL terms, this has been one of or was one of Jerry Richardson's biggest roles, was to lean on other cities to help other NFL owners get stadiums. And Michael Bidwill from the Cardinals told me point blank, that's why he flew across the country to be at Jerry's memorial service, because Jerry personally lobbied on behalf of him to get their new state, well, not new anymore, but their stadium in Glendale, Arizona, because they had been playing in Tempe in a college stadium up to that point. The NFL, like all the other leagues, know that sports is popular. No mayor, no big city mayor is interested in having a team leave on their watch. So there's a leverage that the leagues and sports in general know, is that sports is popular, and football in particular. So over the years, it's gotten more and more elaborate. There are a handful of cities that said thanks, but we just can't do it. New York City is one of them. The Mets and Yankees, when they built baseball stadiums here, did not get any public money for construction. They got tax breaks and other things, but not public money. Or construction money. But you know what? I mean, the mayor of New York knew that the Yankees and Mets were not moving, and I think that's one of the key differences. Would Jacksonville pick up and move to another city? Potentially. But I think ultimately now it's more the politicians than the owners. I think the owners are just asking for whatever they can get away with. It's incumbent on the local officials to say, we don't have the money, or we can only do it this way or that way. And you look at the deal that was just signed with the state of Kansas, and it is gargantuan, the tax breaks that the Chiefs will get. They will be building real estate developments around their training facility that will net them much more money than the stadium will. So these deals have gotten much more complex, and I think a lot of people need to look at what public officials are doing as much as what the owners are trying to get.
Yeah, and as you say, this is a very rich club. The Hunt family, I think, is worth about $25 billion. David Tepper, $24 billion. But you make a good point that people are going to ask for it until someone finally says no, and they're just saying yes. I thought it was interesting that you spent some time talking about, you just mentioned relocations, teams coming and going. The 80s and 90s, there were a lot of teams that moved around. Then it got really quiet for about 20 years, and then there were three teams in the last, I guess, 10 years, the Rams, the Chargers, and the Raiders that relocated. Given all of the money that's swirling around in the league right now, the pieces that have moved and settled, how likely do you think it is that the NFL will either relocate a team or add franchises in the next decade?
I think the first part of the question, I think we went through this spasm. There were the 80s and 90s in particular were very volatile because that was coupled with, I guess you would say, subpar stadiums. And it's hard. I mean, we don't see it anymore. There's very few teams that have this. But by and large, most teams played in baseball stadiums, and they were tenants. They weren't owners. So the owners of the football teams were paying rent to whoever owned the stadium, whether it was municipality or a baseball team, and they could not get any revenue from Taylor Swift coming to town or Monster Jam or all the other events. They were shut out of a lot of that. And so the finances of the league changed dramatically in the 90s when the football owners realized, you know, we need our own stadiums if we're ever going to get, you know, increase our brand and make the most of these buildings. So that started in the 90s, as you pointed out. And then there was a period where there was a lot of stability, with the exception, I believe, of the Texans coming in, but they didn't move. And then we had three teams vying for Los Angeles. We end up in Las Vegas with the Raiders. And so that was tumultuous, but kind of concentrated. I don't see that happening again. I mean, some of the candidates, some of the weaker financial teams, they're not weak, they're less rich, let's put it that way. The Titans in Nashville, the Jacksonville Jaguars in Florida, they're building new stadiums. So Buffalo, Cleveland is now, the Browns are now looking for are going to get a new stadium. So I think the candidates who would have moved are now really not likely to move. There's some talk of the Bears going to Indiana, but that's really just across the border. And as I've pointed out many times, New York Jets and Giants don't play in New York and haven't for more than 40 years. So, and of course, the Chiefs are going to move to Kansas from Missouri. So, you know, that's hardly moving out of the market. The second part of your question about expansion is asked often. I'll just give you some basic math. It has nothing to do with cities, whether they're overseas or in America. But the NFL now shares most of its revenue, more than 60% of it is shared equally between the owners and the players. And so if you add a 33rd team, you are now diluting the amount of money the other 32 owners are going to receive. It's just simple math. So the get-in price, the price to make the owners whole for losing that revenue, is going to be in the billions. So you're now narrowing it down to only a small set of people who are rich enough to buy into the NFL to compensate the other owners for the loss of revenue. That's the first thing. The second thing is the number 32, the NFL loves that. They've got eight divisions of four teams. It's 16 and 16 in each conference. If you go to 34, let's pick that number, now you have 17 and 17. So you're going to have one division with five teams. And now you get the argument you see in baseball, is that one team, most divisions have five, but one has four, and it's easier to get into the playoffs. It's easier to win the division in a team with only three other rivals. So they like the balance of 32. It's a great number, 36 potentially, but now you're diluting by four teams. So I don't think there are, to be honest with you, four cities in America that could sustain an NFL team. Portland, Oregon, maybe, you know, there's some cities out there potentially, but I think the map is pretty well filled in. They've already left St. Louis twice. I don't know if they're going to want to go back again a third time. San Antonio, maybe, but then Jerry Jones is going to object because it's another team in his neighborhood. So I just don't know where those cities are to get to 36. And then you talk about international, but that could take another half an hour.
So let's go back to where we started, which is Super Bowl Sunday and the power of the NFL. It's as a media company. In 2025, of the 100 most watched shows of any kind, sports, news, comedy, mystery, 96 of those were sports, 92 were football, and 84 were the NFL alone. Now they've moved into streaming, as we all know. They're on Netflix. They're on Amazon. There's more money to come if they do this international series. When you look at the NFL, is there any way, or how? Maybe not is there any way, what threatens them as a media property? Because no matter what they throw out, it seems to just get bigger and bigger and bigger.
I ask this of the NFL all the time because it amazes me. You know, you would think with 84 of the top 100 programs being NFL games that you're pretty darn close to saturation. And yet, as they point out, with the combination of streaming and linear television, their audiences are only getting bigger. So while they may not capture many more spots on that list, their audience, their pie is still growing. I think of it in the inverse, which is if you look at American population growth, it's slowing. You know, we have a mature economy, if you want to call it that. And the NFL is recognized, as I witnessed on my job, my day job, it's as recognized an institution in America as exists. The NFL is everywhere. I can tell you stories about meeting people in the middle of an Indian reservation in Arizona and talking with them about the NFL. I have to stop talking to people on airplanes because they want to tell me about their fantasy teams. So it's saturation is a potential issue. And I think that partly is explaining why they're pushing so heavily to find fans overseas. The second issue I always bring up is health and safety. 2023 in January, we had Damar Hamlin almost die on the field. That is something nobody wants to see. But, you know, there's an issue of how many parents are going to put their kids into football. That's persistent. And then, of course, that would only make it much worse or harder for the NFL. The other is gambling. We look at gambling now. You just look at your social media. On any given Sunday now, there is somebody accusing somebody of deliberately kicking a field goal or dropping a pass because it was going to move the betting line or screw somebody out of some bet. I don't know the truth of any of that. I would suspect that's mostly just people sounding off on social media, but it erodes the trust in the game and I guess the integrity of the game. It's not just an NFL issue, but the NFL is the most watched sport, so you see it. It's also the most gambled on sport. And then the fourth thing I often think about is college sports. The NFL has been amazingly fortunate to have not to pay. They don't have to pay for the development of their new athletes. There's no farm system. There's no G League like the NBA has. There's no youth hockey or, you know, that kind of thing in hockey. So they've been very fortunate to have the NCAA do their development work for them. And I think players are changing. NIL money is changing the incentives to stay in college for an extra year. It's changing the attitudes of the players once they get to the NFL. The dynamic is fracturing, probably in ways we don't fully appreciate right now. I note in the book about a talk with some agents who now think their players should not go to the combine, because what's the point? You have all the data on these college players. They have pro days. They have private workouts. They have video from entire college careers. What do you need to go to Indianapolis to go run the 40-yard dash? Oh, it's on ESPN, right? You're giving away your IP. So now you're not getting compensated and you risk pulling a hamstring or something like that. So I think players are going to be a little smarter or shrewder about appearing for nothing and, you know, just feeding the NFL's media machine without compensation.
Let me put you in the 2-minute or less offense, which is we're coming into the final portion of our show. One thing that you're particularly interested in watching the next year, one trend, one issue, what would it be?
AI. AI is already being used by the teams to help analyze injuries, using video and on the football side. I think AI is increasingly going to be used on the business side to figure out how to get you to part with your money faster, figuring out what kind of beer you drink. Mark Donovan, the president of the Chiefs, told me they don't view fans as just arriving to tailgate. They view fans as when they leave their house to when they get home. There's a lot of opportunity from his perspective to engage with you. Now, engage is a very broad word, but it could include discounted merchandise if the Chiefs win a game or whatever. I think AI is going to be pushing that boundary a little bit. A lot of it's already out there. I think it's just going to get more sophisticated.
We will have to leave it there so everyone can get ready for kickoff. Ken Belson, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Ken Belson's new book is called Every Day is Sunday. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.